Good morning. It's good to see you all out this morning. We welcome any guests we have this morning. Of course, we welcome those joining us on Facebook as well. We're continuing our series of lessons sort of on the life of Daniel, going against the wind, against the flow, however maybe you want to say that, kind of deeply holding on to our held convictions in a modern day Babylon, without giving in, without really pushing back, without giving up or pulling away. So how do we do such a thing to keep our feet firmly planted in a culture that's growing more apathetic towards Christianity, I think, every day? And we live in a modern day Babylon. Last week we began to answer that question of living life against the wind, talking about Daniel chapter 1 and the things that Daniel has to teach us. Well, remember we talked about how Daniel and his friends were part of the first deportation into Babylon after Jerusalem is conquered. And they were also made into eunuchs. They were trained and educated in the Babylonian system and in the world and in their language, all of those things in order to serve in the king's court. And that's exactly what Daniel and his friends were able to do. That's what we talked about last week. So this week we're going to talk a little bit about chapter 2. I encourage you, Daniel builds upon itself. Daniel, as you read it, it assumes that what you were reading, you read before that. So I would say, if you haven't read Daniel chapter 1 or maybe wasn't here last week, I would encourage you to read Daniel chapter 1. But Daniel chapter 2 begins in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. And a lot of times in today's thinking, we say if you're having trouble sleeping, maybe you're having a guilty conscience, right? That's what we like to say. But in their time, it really wasn't about conscience. When they had a dream, they believed that was a way of the gods communicating to humans, especially in dreams, especially to kings. The kings were known as God's representatives on earth, and so they believed that the gods spoke to them in dreams. This isn't necessarily a wrong belief, right? If we continue reading the Old Testament and we read the rest of the Bible, God shows up in dreams more often than not. That's how he communicates. And so this was an understanding that even other cultures understood as well. They believed this, and so he didn't know what the dream meant. And so the king commanded that the magicians and the enchanters and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans he had summoned to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king, and the king said to them, "I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream." Nebuchadnezzar is a pretty wise leader. The first thing he does here whenever he has a question is he pulls all of the wise men of the kingdom together and he says, "I need an answer, right? We need to talk about this." It is a good practice, I think, for you to go gather up people when a decision needs to be made. Not everything needs to be done by ourselves. Maybe sometimes the Lord is unclear. Sometimes we're not sure what the Lord is doing. It's a good practice, I think, to reach out to others and to get wise counsel. So you can't really fault Nebuchadnezzar here for searching wise counsel amongst the wise men of his kingdom. Of course, we would do that as well if we were in Nebuchadnezzar's shoes, but he kind of does this in a really weird way, as Paul pointed out, because what he wants the enchanters and the astrologers and the wise men of the kingdom to do, part of their training was to do this dream interpretations, right? But Nebuchadnezzar takes it a step further. He wants to know if these guys are the real deal or not, or if they're just kind of trying to mess with him, and says, "I'll tell you what, you guys tell me the dream and tell me the interpretation of it. I'm not going to give you anything." And that's insane, right? One of you all, anybody, stand up right now and tell me what I dreamt last night. You can't do it, right? It's an impossible thing to do. And everybody back then agrees so as well. The astrologers in verse 10, they say, "There is no man on earth who can meet the king's command, For no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with the flesh. And we need to remember that's a very powerful phrase that we need to hold on to. No one can show it to the kings except the gods whose dwelling is not with the flesh. Nebuchadnezzar wants to know if these wise men were legit or if they're just playing games, and he gets his answer, and it makes him furious. Nebuchadnezzar is not a king who plays around. We'll see that he kind of likes to fly off the handle, it seems. He's one who is willing and able to say, you know what, let's just kill them all. And that's sort of what happens here. Because of this, the king was angry and very furious and commanded all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. Let's just start over, right? So the decree went out and the wise men were about to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Once again, we find Daniel is caught in the consequences of someone else's iniquity, right? In chapter 1, but by no fault of Daniel, he is forced into exile in Babylon. By no fault of Daniel, he is made into a eunuch. But by no fault of his own, he's given a new name. He's taught the Babylonian culture. By no fault of his own, now his life is under the shadow of the death penalty. That's where Daniel is. But even in that situation, he remains calm. Verse 14 says, Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He declared to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree of the king so urgent? Then Arioch made the matter known to Daniel, and Daniel went in and requested the king to appoint him a time that he might show the interpretation to the king. Verse 17 says, then Daniel went to his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Daniel, he uses tact, right? He uses tact and he asks the king for more time. I think it might be a little bit interesting to note that Daniel and his friends are not with the wise men and the astrologers during the first conversation that Nebuchadnezzar has about his dream, because I think if they were there, the conversation would have went a little bit different. They wouldn't have certainly had to go search for him. Maybe it's a timing issue. Maybe it's a mission issue. We learn in chapter 1 that Daniel is given a pretty high position in the kingdom, so maybe he's out of Babylon at the moment. We don't know exactly. I would speculate one other thing that I would say, that Daniel and his friends aren't in there because Daniel and his friends don't really dabble in the occult. What these wise men and astrologers and magicians was doing are what we would call occult practices in today's speak. They were doing the practices like the horoscope and the diviners and all the different things that they were looking for to provide answers. And Daniel doesn't do that. Daniel doesn't dabble in anything that isn't of God, which should probably be a good point for the rest of us, right? That we should be very careful in dabbling in anything that isn't of God. It doesn't matter, really, if it seems harmless. Maybe it is. But we really, I don't think, should be messing around with things, because there are powers that are in this world, and not all of those powers like us. Then I think there's one power that we can always trust, and that's the one that Daniel leans into. And so he asks King Nebuchadnezzar for more time, and then he goes to his friends, and they ask the King of Kings for more wisdom. And again, as we said, that's a good thing to do. Not just asking God for wisdom, but whenever you're in a bind, get your friends together. And all of you go and ask God for wisdom. Because in Babylon, we all need, like Sergeant Pepper, right? We all need a little help from our friends. The mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. And then Daniel stops and he praises God. The very first thing that Daniel does when the vision is revealed is not go and save his own skin. He doesn't go and immediately say to the king, I have the answer. I know what it is. What Daniel does in verses 20 and 23 is he stops and he praises God. And again, another great practical application for all of us. When God reveals himself, we should stop and praise him. Well, we shouldn't wait till tomorrow. We shouldn't wait until we get home. We shouldn't wait until something is a little bit more convenient for us. We should stop right then and there, just like Daniel does, because it's very important for Daniel. He knows that Nebuchadnezzar is one that flies off the handle. The interpretation of the dream that he's about to give could very well be the last words that Daniel ever speaks. Daniel may never get a chance to praise his God again. And so he takes a moment and he stops and he praises God. And then in verse 24 it says, therefore Daniel went into Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went in and said thus to him, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show the king the interpretation. So the first thing, Daniel praises God. The second thing is he goes and speaks on behalf of those who do dabble in the occult. And I would put it this way, Daniel does not hold in contempt those who hold different convictions than he does. He doesn't say, you know what? Those guys made their bed, and now it's time they can lie in it. I mean, if we got rid of all of those people, now Christ, now God could truly be proclaimed, right? If we get rid of all the naysayers, all of those people holding back the message of Christ, and now we're in charge? And Daniel's like, that's not the way the kingdom of God works. Daniel pleads on behalf of those who don't hold the same convictions of them. We live in a modern-day Babylon. How many Christians out there are pleading on behalf of the people who don't hold the same convictions as we do? Or rather, how many of us are willing to condemn and to throw stones at anyone who doesn't hold the same convictions as us? Daniel is teaching us how to live against the flow, and it's not waging war the way that the world does. It's wanting that all to come to repentance. It's wanting that all to see the light and to see the glory of God. See, he knows that the light of God can shine brightly. So in verse 26, the king declared to Daniel, whose name was Belshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream that I have seen and its interpretation? And Daniel answered the king and said, no wise man, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show to the king the mystery that the king has asked. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he makes known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. When you believe that there is a God in heaven, it changes everything. Babylon is a tough place to live. It's a wicked place, and all you have to do, right, is for us to turn on our TV news, and we see that. We're not talking about ancient Babylon. We're talking about Babylon where we live, and it's not hard to recognize. You turn on the news, and you see how far from God our world is, and it's a difficult place. And sometimes all we do is focus so much on the bad and we get so discouraged. And the thing that we really need to realize is you don't survive Babylon but by focusing on the greatness of the wickedness that surrounds you. You survive Babylon but by focusing on the greatness and mercy of God. There is a God in heaven. I think it would be so great if we're able to get to heaven and we can kind of roll back the tape and watch different scenes, because I would love to see this conversation between Daniel and King Nebuchadnezzar. I want to see how he says, but there is a God in heaven, because I know in my heart it is with conviction. And I know there's something right there that it just sort of gives a person chills. Thinking about how Daniel stood up to the king of the whole world, and said this phrase, but there's a God in heaven. You know, may we have that kind of conviction in the Babylon we live today. Daniel went on to reveal not just the interpretation of the dream, but the dream itself, proving that God is legitimate. Verse 31, he says, "You saw, O king, and behold, a great image. This image, mighty and of exceeding brightness, stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. The head of the image was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. As you looked, a stone was cut out by no human hand, and it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them into pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold all together were broken in pieces and became like chaff on the summer threshing floor, and the wind carried them away, so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." Daniel goes on to explain what the dream means. He tells Nebuchadnezzar that God has given him insight into the future, what's about to happen to the world empires. The gold is Nebuchadnezzar. This is the Babylonian Empire. Following that, you'll have the Medes and the Persians, which we'll actually see towards the end of the book of Daniel as well. And after that, the Greek Empire, and then the Roman Empire, and then you get to the iron and clay, and we could get off into the weeds and really talk about what that means. Maybe it's the divided Rome kingdom, where part of Rome's kingdom was in Rome and part was in Constantinople. Maybe it's the papal system, or maybe it's a modern understanding of what we're dealing with now. There's a lot of interpretations about what that last little bit really is and what it's talking about. And the reason that I bring it up is that so many people get so focused on what each part of the statue is and what it means that they sort of forget the purpose. And the purpose is what happens to the statue, right? It gets obliterated, right? So much so that it says there's not even any dust left around. It's reduced to dust and it's blown away. That's what happens to the statue. And so some people spend so much time focusing on the statue, they miss the point. The rock shows up, right? The rock of ages endures forever. That's the point. The rock is coming. What Daniel is telling Nebuchadnezzar is the future does not belong to you, Nebuchadnezzar. Today, a lot of us, we get worried about legacy, right? Especially as you sort of get towards the end of life and you're wondering, have I passed certain things on? Have I done enough? How are people going to remember me? That's not a new idea. Ever since we figured out we were going to die, we have been concerned with the mark that we are leaving. King Nebuchadnezzar, as any good king would want, he wants to establish a kingdom that is going to outlast him. One that will go from generation to generation, all because of what he's done. This glorious nation, and what Daniel is saying is, Nebuchadnezzar, you may have good plans, but they're not going to play out. Kingdoms come and kingdoms go. The future belongs to the God of Israel. That's what Daniel is saying, that the God that you believe, that you just whooped whenever you came into Jerusalem and you carried all of us away in captivity, that's the God who holds the future. That's the rock of ages. Verse 44 says, "In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom, and they shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break into pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever. Just as you saw that a stone was cut away from the mountain by no human hand, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, a great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation sure." So Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar are given a glimpse of what God is going to do in the future. That they get a glimpse of the coming Messiah, right? That's the point. It's the coming Messiah. It's that Jesus is coming and is going to break up all of the nations, because his kingdom will never end. And so what does Nebuchadnezzar do with the information? You kind of wonder, Daniel has to hold his breath for a second, right? What's he going to do? It says Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and he paid homage to Daniel and commanded that an offering and incense be offered up to him. The king answered and said to Daniel, "Truly, your God is a God of gods and Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this mystery." Now, don't think for a second that Nebuchadnezzar here is worshiping God, because he's not, right? It's sort of the first steps, and how it works is what he's doing is he's actually worshiping Daniel. And Daniel's God sort of through him, but that's certainly a much better response than off with their heads, right? This is a small stepping stone. Nebuchadnezzar hasn't come full around to praising God fully just yet, but he has come to the place of saying, you know what? God or Jesus is probably real, and I see it in you, Daniel. I see the God that you praise, that you worship, is true, and I want to worship that same God, but I sort of just want to do it through you in this moment. Now, Daniel, again, was forced into service by this king. The same Daniel now being forced into service by King Nebuchadnezzar praises God that he thought he had whooped sometime back in Jerusalem. That's a pretty cool turnaround. So just quick, three takeaways about sort of living life against the wind there, and we'll go and eat pretty quick. Number one, real faith is not developed in a vacuum. It's not easy to live in Babylon. We could ask Daniel. It's not easy. Ask our neighbors. We are in Babylon. But our faith, I believe, is truly developed when we courageously stand with God in grace. Our faith is strengthened. We all desire, I think. And I think all of us desire what's easy. None of us want really what's hard. We want the safe things. We want what's easy. But we keep saying this idea of going against the flow, against the wind. But you know what doesn't go against the wind? It's dead fish. The only thing that sort of goes against the flow, goes against anything, are things that are alive. Only the living can go against the flow. And so you might as well check your spiritual living card if you want to, because if you want an easy life, it's not going to be living spiritually for God. That's what's easy, is to not do what's for God. If you want an easy life, you're basically saying, I'm spiritually dead. And I don't think any of us in this room this morning want that. But our faith is developed in Babylon. I might even argue that Babylon is a good place to get even closer to God, because God is relentlessly pursuing Babylonians. That's why Jesus ate with sinners. That's why all over the New Testament, Jesus is accused so many times of hanging out with the wrong crowd. It is because God is pursuing the wrong crowd to make them part of his kingdom. So if you want to get close to God, it's not on some mountaintop. It's not getting away from all the culture and all humanity and escaping all of this. It's going straight into the people that don't know God yet, because that's where God is. Relentlessly pursuing your faith, and your faith will be developed the more when you take your stance in Babylon. So that's number one. Faith is not developed in a vacuum. Second, it's not, the future is not for kings to decide. You notice that in the story, some of us get so worked up about what all is going on in our world today. What this nation's doing to this nation, what this person is saying about that person. And we get so worked up, and you think, the future, man, I just don't know. Well, what's going on? That the future is up for grabs. Bible disagrees. It's not. Because there's a God in heaven who holds the future in his grasp. He's not letting go for anybody. The future is not up for grabs, because I know who holds the future. We'll just let that song. I know who holds tomorrow. That's the guy, right? God is the guy. So I don't have to worry and get all upset about what even my own nation is doing, much less what other nations are doing. Do I want to affect change? Absolutely. Do I want Babylon to come to the realm of Christ? Yes. But I don't put my faith And I don't put my trust in some statue that's not going to last. It is important that we as believers don't get all worked up on the announcements and boasts or powers that will not last. Psalms 2 says it like this, that the kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. This is one of the few times that we're told that God actually laughs. And it's whenever people think they have the power, God laughs. He laughs at them. He laughs at the rulers that think that they are in charge. And so maybe here's the thing. If you're worried about the future, you might be putting more hope in a statue than you are in the rock. And we need to put our faith in the right place. So that takes us to our last takeaway. Our foundation is not shook or not shaken if it is built on the rock. It can't be if it is built on the rock. And you know, these sort of things, that they last about 5 years that we've been through. Since COVID, these have been kind of hard times. You can look around. Our congregation seems to be shrinking, right? COVID has highlighted missing places in pews, but all across everywhere, churches are seeing fewer preachers, fewer ministers of any sort that are coming into churches than there ever has been, and that's a scary thing too, right? But we shouldn't lose hope. I don't know what the future looks like, but I am convinced that God is in charge, and whenever your foundation is the rock, you cannot be shaken. You are on the firmest foundation that there is. And it doesn't matter what the world tries to throw at you when your foundation is the rock of ages. It might get windy. That's a fact. It might get tough. But don't fret. There's no reason to. Our faith is not a statue. And it's not in a statue, it's in the rock of ages. If we're going to thrive in Babylon, we've got to start putting our hope in the rock. And not just in some statue. If we're going to live against the flow, then we've got to show people a better way. And the thing is, when we do that, when we show people a better way, just as Daniel did to King Nebuchadnezzar, people notice that. Now, they may not come running to faith in that moment, but they're going to take notice and they're going to stop. Because when they notice someone takes a stand and says, but there is a God in heaven with conviction and with clarity, people notice that. And when that God in heaven does amazing things, then who knows, right? Maybe we then can change the world because we're all standing on the rock of ages. It's exactly what Jesus called us to do. Jesus didn't call us to just be part of the crowd. Jesus calls us to take a stand and to really convict the world, to not be shaken, but to show the world what it looks like when you are in your faith with God. And so if you're here this morning, maybe having never put Christ on in baptism, Christ was brutally crucified for our sins. And this morning, if you're here having never recognized that and you're ready to put Christ on in baptism, then the baptismal waters are ready for you. If you're here this morning and maybe you don't have a need of any kind, let's just kind of have a little thought exercise as we finish up. Sort of as we go through this song, I would like to ask that you make a recommitment to God. So just take a moment as we're singing, right where you're at, and just ask, Lord, I'm ready to make you my rock. Whenever bad times come, that's where I'm going to stand. I think we can get a whole lot less worried when we turn our focus towards God and not on the problems of the world. So that's sort of, I guess, our homework for the week. I encourage you to do that. But again, if you're not part of Christ and you're ready to do that, we are so ready for you to do that as well. Please come, whatever your need may be, as we stand and we sing.